It's nice to have a partisan crowd. My name is Lloyd. I'm an alcoholic dope fiend. I don't know Lloyd Al either. My name's Lloyd G. And I'm a member of the dugout. It doesn't say that on the program either. It says something else. But anyway.
It says Lloyd L from the dugout. D-O-U-G.
Yeah, right. When I was asked to speak at the institutional meeting, I automatically said yes. And I said yes because I felt right at home that you would ask me to do this. Because I had spent a lot of my time, a lot of my years in Alcoholics Anonymous in institutions. And so I'm usually one of the clients sitting out there with a guard escort watching me. So this is new, a new experience for me to be, in fact, free and coming of my own volition out here, not having been in an institution for almost 13 years. Now, I say almost 13 years because I'm almost 13 years sober. So if we go back a little bit, I never, from the time I was 15, never missed going to jail. Never missed a year. And sort of it seemed to me that that was part and parcel of what happened when you drank. There were a few years where I didn't go to court because I was in the federal penitentiary. And when I look at my record, it's interesting how it all of a sudden stops when I sobered up, coincidentally. So if there's anybody here who's doing any time, please take note that if you stay sober, quite likely you won't end up in jail. Although I did that too. I'm not going to go into that particular story this morning. It has to do with the border guards and stuff. I just told the guy, I'm coming down here to buy cheese and eggs. You know what I mean? They locked me up for 4 days. I've never been back to buy cheese and eggs in the United States. I'd like to tell you about a particular time to just give you an indication of what kind of a drunk I was, if you don't know that already. I was in Calgary, and I'd gone to Calgary not because I like Calgary. I'd gone to Calgary because I tried to learn how to drive out here. And as I recall, this lady I lived with had a Volkswagen, and I didn't know how to drive. I was 30 years old, and I stayed away from cars because I was a drunk, and I knew it wasn't a good idea. I was going to jail quite frequently without driving. But she'd passed out. She didn't drink. I used to give her Neocitrin, double hits of Neocitrin, and play soft music. And she'd go to sleep, and this one day I stole her car. And because I don't know how to drive, I rolled it going up Simon Fraser Mountain into a ditch. And I was sitting on the side of the ditch when the police arrived, and they asked me what I was doing, and they were going to walk towards the car in the ditch that was upside down. And I just kicked out the back window and climbed out, and I said, "Oh, you can't go down there." And they said, "Why?" And I said, "Because it'll blow up. It always blows up on TV," which is why I got out of there real fast. I lost my license, the one I didn't have, for 6 months. And we're slated to do things over and over. 2 weeks later, the same woman bought another car, another Volkswagen, but it was 10 years older. I wonder why. And I did the same thing and stole that car. I didn't get a chance to drive it up Simon Fraser Mountain because I come so close to sideswiping this Lincoln, the guy actually pulled over to the side of the road to sort of pray or something, and And I realized I was in bad shape driving this thing. And there was a hitchhiker. I almost ran him over with school books and stuff, and I asked him if he would drive me to the nearest liquor store. And he did. But on the way, we were surrounded by cops. And I'm screaming, "It's not his fault, it's not his fault, it's me." And one cop looked at the other and said, "Well, it's Lloyd, yeah, it is not his fault." So I was slated to go to court again. And I thought, I've lost my license that I don't have for 6 months. I don't think I really want to go to court. So that's how I ended up in Calgary. And when I was in Calgary, I was at the hostel, and I lived in the floor of the hostel for a year. Now, the progression of this disease is such that I wasn't accustomed to living on floors of hostels. I'll maybe get back to that a little later, but this was a new experience for me. But I was so disgusted with my life and so fed up with myself and just such a mess that I stayed in this hostel with a bunch of other, and I say this in a nice way, tramps, my buddies on the street, the alcoholics who can't quit drinking. These were my friends. And we had this big family there at the hostel. Anyway, one morning, I was always waking up quite often in the drunk tank of the Calgary Bucket. Now, the drunk tank and any drunk tank, if there's a lot of drunks in town, they have to stack you and stuff on top of each other. And you always know before you wake up that you're in the drunk tank because you got somebody's foot in your face, you got somebody's elbow in your crotch, and it's got this putrid smell, that sour putrid smell of sweaty bodies. Do you know the smell? I see a few people's noses going up. What a horrible smell that is. And you know you're in the drunk tank. Well, this particular morning I woke up and I was going first class. I had my own little room, my own little cell. And I thought, this is all right, they know who I am. And as I was sitting there, I got to wondering, well, in order to get this private room, you have to have committed a crime other than drinking in public. And thinking about that, I started to look at myself, and I had started this whole thing about 3 days before looking rather good. And there I was, covered in blood. And I had a white Pierre Cardin, that's important in this story, shirt that I'd gotten from the Salvation Army, and matching strides. And I was sitting there in these light-colored blue pants and shirt were covered in blood. And so automatically I checked myself out, and I didn't seem to have any, everything was there. And I thought, well, I guess it has to be somebody else's blood. I'm pretty quick sometimes. And I asked for the guard to come over, and I was screaming and hollering about, what am I charged with? He said, well, Lloyd, because he knew me, he said, it's the big one this time, man. It's the big one. Shook his head and he walked away. Now, I'm sitting there, or standing there, and I'm thinking, the big one, there is only one big one. That's murder one. And I thought, this is possible, because like you, I have in my imagination killed all kinds of people. And I know you have too. Right? So we know we're capable. And so my problem was, who was it? I hope it wasn't a friend of mine. I hope it's somebody I don't like. And I hope it's a male. And when I was thinking all these things, my knees gave out and I had to sit down on the bed. I was so full of fear. So I had to wait there about a half an hour, and then the guard officer. Now that I'm recovered, I call them nice names. He came over and he said, "Well, come on, Lloyd, we're going to court." And I said, I can't get up. So he called one of his buddies, and the two of them escorted me, lifted me up, and carried me into court. That's why I don't like these podiums. I always feel like I'm in court. And he reads out on his charge, the prosecutor. He says, "On or about in the province of Alberta, did you commit the crime of theft under and steal a 5-pound roast beef?" I said, "Guilty! I'm guilty!" I was never so happy to be a thief in all my life. Those are some kinds of things that used to happen to me. Another time, I'm not going to tell this story because it's too long, but I ended up in a church wearing all these priest robes and stuff. And I thought I was the Pope, but that story takes too long. The frustration of being a drunk and knowing you're a drunk, you know, talking about institutions. When I found out I was a drunk at 15, I went to court for willful damage. And first time I'd ever been to court in my life, 15 years old. And the judge looked at me and he said, "You're an alcoholic. And you need to go to the Alcoholic Foundation and get well." That's what they had at that time. And I'd go there with my school books in Edmonton on 5th Street. And the people there would look at me and say, "Well, are you here to look for your father?" Or I said, "No, I have an appointment for me." And that was kind of weird back in those days. But you see, I didn't buy it. I didn't buy the fact that I had this problem with drinking. Drinking for me was the important thing, the one thing that made all the difference in my life. It was, in fact, at 15 when I first started to drink, it was the one thing that made me okay. It was the one thing that allowed me to be a 100% whole. It allowed me, I was a skinny kid, and it allowed me, and full of all kinds of shame and stuff, and it allowed me to be this huge, muscle-bound, debonair, suave, cool guy. And like, if you can find something that will do that for you, I guess you'd get attached to it, you know? And that's basically what happened. I got rather attached to that stuff. And I drank for the next 24 years, I drank as much as I could for as long as I could. And that last tin of Lysol was just enough, you know what I mean? I was squeezing the last drops out of that sucker, and that was just enough. I had finally drank enough. I don't recommend it. Aqua Valva is better, but then you can't be choosy, you know what I'm saying? You know, this is weird for me to talk about that kind of stuff because I ended up in the restaurant business. And partly because there's booze there. I mean, when I look back, I said, how did I end up in this business? Well, it's because there was booze there. I was always close to booze. And so it made sense then for the next 20-some years, I stayed in that business. You know, and I became a French service waiter because one time I was doing time in Center Creek, and in order to get out, we had to do a parole thing, so I had to take a course, and I took a waiter's course in French service. And I can create these wonderful things at your table, crepe Suzette's and banana flambés and steak Diane and Chateaubriand and all this French shit. I can do, and I worked in first-class joints, I'll have you know. I would do things like at Heise. If you worked at Heise, you sort of made it in this town. And Well, I remember working at Heise, and I had some rather rich people of the Jewish persuasion there, and I was making Caesar salad. Well, Caesar salad, I remember when the instructor was telling me how to prepare Caesar salad, it's of utmost importance that you toss the salad. Like, you gotta toss the salad. And I was half pissed about this time they wanted the Caesar salad, and I'd remembered this guy saying, toss the salad. So I was getting into tossing the salad, and the whole restaurant was watching the salad floating around, croutons are flying all over the place. And I was getting right into it, as I say, and eight people are sitting there sort of mesmerized by the salad. And by the time I stopped, I looked in the bowl, there wasn't any salad in the bowl. It was all over the gyridon. And I didn't miss a beat. I just continued, got their plates and took it off the gyridon and stuck it on their plate, stuck it in front of them. And I stood there. One guy started to eat. What are you gonna do? I worked at another place. I didn't have these jobs for long. Spanish coffee was my thing. I was the greatest Spanish coffee maker that this town's ever seen. And again, when you make Spanish coffee, you know, I'd see other waiters make it, and when you start it on fire, they'd hold it in front of them like this, like it was this big secret. I had the sucker right up here, and I had three times as much booze in it as you needed, and I'd swirl the sucker around. Well, one day, I was a little too drunk this particular day. I remember it was 13 women. This one woman was having an anniversary or something. She just had open heart surgery, I don't know. And I'm throwing this coffee around, and it splashed. This is a dark dining room. Splashed on the table in front of her. The table sort of was on fire. And they all sort of screamed, which made me more nervous, and I threw some more on the table. And it bounced off the table onto her. Now she was on fire. And you have those waiter's napkins. So there I'm standing there beating this woman, putting out the fire. And the maitre d' is standing there watching all of this, along with the rest of the people in the restaurant. I think that was my last night at that particular establishment. You know, it's interesting with alcoholics, like we're not too swift. You know what I became after I became a French service waiter? A bartender. It just doesn't make much sense. Our thinking, you know, it gets back to when I came around here, my problem really is how I think. I don't think the way normal people think. I don't know why that is. I left this morning to come here. I didn't even know where the hell this place was. I mean, most people, I guess normal people, they would figure out where it was. But not us. And I go with two women who don't know where it is either. And they're alcoholics as well. That's not a surprise. You know, if you come around this outfit and you're desperate because you look at your life sometime when you're sitting in jail, as I did, and cried no tears. No tears. I hate that story about a guy sits in a cell and he just falling apart and crying and all that. I've never seen that, you know. In all the times I've been in jail, I have never seen that scene. What I have seen is guys who are bitter and twisted and saying, I can handle this shit. And any more that you've got to hand me, this not a big deal. This not a big deal. That's the way I was. I was dead inside. It didn't matter what you handed me. I could handle it. I remember I accidentally stabbed this guy in this town in a bar because he was a waiter. He's pretty slow service, this guy. And they were telling me that with a beer glass, actually, they were telling me that I could go to jail for a long time for doing that. And I, you know, I looked at my history 7 years locked up, and I didn't want to go back. I didn't want to go back. And I thought, you know, that day I just went into a bar to have a few drinks. Now they want to take 7 years of my life. Like I don't understand this. And when those things start to happen in your life, you start to wonder, like, how desperate do we have to be? How desperate, you know, you look for answers. I was in my 30s when that happened. And I looked around at all those years where I'd gone places. I'd gone to all kinds of places looking for help. Why was it at 30 years old I was still drinking like a pig? I was still doing all kinds of drugs and shit. Like, I wasn't finding the answer. You know, all the doctors that I had been to had got me wired to shit like Valium and Halcyon. I went to this doctor in town here. He was in the paper for administering drugs illegally or something. He made over $1 million. It was in the paper that year. I won't mention his name because I don't want to get sued. But his first initial is F. Anyway, I go to this doctor and I tell him, like, I'm falling apart. I'm going crazy. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a dope fiend. Can you please help me? And he says, well, Lloyd, I think what you need is you need to take some Valium. I said, Doc, I don't like Valium. I've heard about Valium. I know guys who use and abuse Valium. They give it to me in the detox all the time. I don't really like it. He said, no, I think you need 3 Valiums a day. How do you sleep, he says. Can you imagine asking an alcoholic, how do you sleep? I mean, after you haven't had nothing to drink, fitfully at best, how do I sleep? What a loaded question. So I told him that, and he said, well, you need 2 Halcyons every night. You know, and you're stuck in that place where you're so sick of, if somebody says hello, you're stuck for an answer. You don't know what to say. You know that place. That's when they ask you in detox. About the 3rd day they ask you. So what do you want to do with the rest of your life? Notice that they always ask you about the 3rd day. All I could ever say was treatment. I could just manage to get that word out. So doctors, you know, I ended up getting my stomach pumped 3 different times for overdosing on Valium and Halcyon. And my plan was to pass out somewhere in a back alley between some garbage cans, and nobody would find me and I could die. That's what I wanted to do. Because I went to a doctor. Does that make any sense? You know, we get a little frustrated. When I was 20 years old, I got picked up for smoking dope. Not a big deal. But I end up in BC Penn. Now I'm an alcoholic and I'm a dope fiend, and I'm 20 years old. If you can imagine what I looked like 30 years ago, a little better than today. Honest. I come waltzing into BC Penn, and some of them mad dogs and some of those people they had there, like, I had hair about a little longer than this, actually, and the next minute I was bald. That's like being castrated, in case you don't know what that feels like. That's what that's like. I had lost, I didn't know who in the hell I was now. And they said to me, go through that door and go pick up your laundry and stuff, your bedding and your sheets. And I thought, I'll go into another room and do this. So I open up the door and I'm stepping out and I look up, and you've seen those big round bird cages? Well, that was the dome in BC Penn. It was this huge 5-story dome birdcage thing. There are 5 tiers of men. There's the last Friday of every month. The fish come in. And if you're anybody in the pen, you're there to watch the show. Might be an old friend of yours. So I come walking through, I see all these men hanging there, and they're starting to scream. And I'm thinking, my God, they're screaming at me. And they seem rather excited. I walk right across that dome to where my laundry was, and I bent down to pick it up. The place went nuts. And I thought, I ain't gonna leave here alive. You know, the establishment knows all that. It set it up that way. This is a guy that's terribly sick, dying of this disease, and this is what happens to me for help. They locked me up for 2 years in a place like that with maniacs. You know, they used to wonder why we get bitter and twisted. I love that word, twisted. That just says it all for me. Twisted! You're goddamn right, I'm twisted! You know, so we end up going to treatment centers and shit, right? And what happens in those places? Well, hopefully, recovery programs. But you see, if you come in and you're like me, you can't hear. My problem is I can't hear what you're saying. I couldn't hear it. They said, I mean, I can tell anybody here, you want to change the rest of your life, the quality of your life. Do you want to have a life? It's simple. Simple as hell, and it's my responsibility to tell you what to do. First of all, get yourself a big book. That's the directions. That's the textbook on how drunks, lifestyle-drinking and scumbag like me stay sober. And like, don't be intimidated by it. There's only 164 pages here that need to be looked at, really. You know, the rest is filler, so you don't lose the goddamn thing. Gives it a nice size, a nice weight, you know what I mean? Some of you guys think you're being ripped off, so they just want to give you a bigger book, you know? But just 164 pages. You know, when I, after all those years, I finally decided I'm going to read the book. It wasn't one day I woke up and thought, oh, I think I'll read the book. No, that's not how it happened. I had to be coaxed, conned, connived, and manipulated into reading the book. Isn't that incredible? After 13 and a half years in treatment centers, I should make this a just so you know, I've been in treatment, I'm not trying to break any records here, there's one. Over 30 times in treatment. I used to say 27 because I thought I didn't want to hit the 30 mark. People would think there was a problem with me or something. But last time I counted, it was 27, and I remember somebody said to me who knew me, they said, Lloyd, you didn't even mention the Union Gospel Mission. You were there twice. And you didn't mention Cartier Manor. You were there once. And I said, okay, I get your point. So I'm going to try and get a little more honest. It was over 30 times I was in treatment. See, I was a professional. That's what I did for a living. I was a professional patient. I remember telling a policeman that one time. He said, what do you do anyway, Lloyd? I said, well, I'm a professional patient. I get sick and then I get well. But usually not for long. You know, I gave up that occupation. I gave it up because I was at the end of my rope. I couldn't carry that job on for too much longer. That job, I couldn't get sick too many more times. That last time, I think, was about it for me. And like the best I could do, we're at an institutional roundup. The best I could do, this head where the problem is, the best I could do was say, I'm tired of these back alleys. I'm tired. I was sitting in the McDonald's. I just ran into a store on Davy Street, a drugstore. And I ran in, and I know where the Lysol is kept there. See, I couldn't walk through the store because the way I looked, people would be on to me right away. So I had to run in when the cashier people were busy, grab the Lysol, and run out the door and show them that that's what I had in case they thought it was something important. And like they see it's a tin of Lysol, they ain't going to chase me down the street. So I'm drinking this Lysol in McDonald's because it's so goddamn cold out. It's wintertime. It's November. I'm sleeping outside, and I'm freezing. I haven't eaten for 2 weeks, and I'm absolutely nuts, and I'm mad, and I'm bitter, and twisted. Twist, because nothing. And as I'm sitting there, I'm thinking of murder. I'm thinking all these people, it's their fault. It's their fault. I'm going to get even. And then I'm thinking, I'll drink this Lysol, and when it kicks in, you know, when you get that, meh, and then I'll just start thinking about my life. And that's all I need. I'm going to walk into some store, get some guy about this high. I hope I can find some guy about that high. I'm going to hit him with whatever's there, frying pan, if it's a hardware store, whatever. And I'm just going to do him in. And like if I kill him, it don't matter to me just as well. Like I don't care at this point because I want to go to jail. I want to go to the pen for about 20 years. I want to be a professional dope fiend in there. I want to be a drunk in there. I made all kinds of wonderful, wonderful batches of booze when I worked in the kitchen in several joints in this province and others. So it's possible. Like, what a place to send somebody who's got a drug problem. Let's send them to jail. I mean, if you want to score, you might want to go to the joint to score some days. It's like they would send homosexuals to prison.
Oh, is this ever nice?
How many men are here?
About 600.
Doesn't make sense to me. You know, like we gotta wake up. So I come back, finally, I come back to this place. I come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because I want to be here, because no place else will have me. That's why I don't like it when people pat me on the back and say, well, Lloyd, you know, you tried so many times and we really admire that. And that's a bunch of crap. I don't deserve any pat on the back. I came here because nobody else would have me except you people. Imagine that. No one else would have me. And I come to these meetings and scream and holler, drunk wine bottles would fall out of my pocket. And you say to me, keep coming back. What? I'd steal your money. Keep coming back, Lloyd. You know, I had no place else to go. So when I finally got here and I finally got 3 months sober, never had a drink because the welfare wouldn't give me any money. That's the only reason. And at 3 months sober, thinking clearly, I looked around. I'm in a treatment center with a bunch of wackos like you people. And some of you are laughing and shit. And I said to my buddy Wayne, I said, what are you laughing at? Wake up! Look around! Bunch of maniacs here. What's so funny? You don't have a goddamn thing. He said, Lloyd, I feel good.
You feel good.
I said, so what kind of weed is that, Wayne? He said, you're a sick sucker, Lloyd. I'm reading step three. I said, you're reading step three. I thought you were solid. You believe this shit? Do you believe this shit? I've been here for years. I don't believe this shit. I said, yeah, that's the problem.
Lloyd. You know, and he had, when I heard him laugh, he had that innocent sound of just carefree, free, joyous laughter that one hears in children. And I so desperately wanted that. I so desperately, that sound was the sound of music to my ears. I so desperately wanted, I'd remembered that sound. I so desperately wanted to be able to laugh like that. And so, I started to read the book. For the first time in my life, in the horror story of my life, I finally started to read the book. So if I have any alcoholics out here, you know, I have a message for you. Because I know the way you think. So I'm going to tell you this. Don't read the book. Don't read it. Don't read it. You know, maybe your story can be longer than mine. Don't ever consider internalizing the steps, because maybe then you will become a successful, joyful human being. Do it my way. If you live so long. No. I looked at step two. Step two was a problem for me, because it says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I was a little offended by that. These people are telling me I'm nuts. Can you imagine after what I've just told you? Now I'm concerned that they're suggesting I might be a little crazy. But then I looked at that step and they're talking about, you know, talking about God. Now I have a big problem there too, see, because I was an altar boy and stuff, and I won't go into that whole thing, and I won't go into the whole thing with other institutions that I got involved in with regards to that. It was frustrating and it was painful. So I'm at this step two and I'm reading this thing about God. Came to believe. I'm there about 3 months, actually not about, precisely 3 months and one day. I'm on step two. I've written about the horror of my story in step one. And now I'm looking at this step, and I'm thinking, came to believe. Came. Well, came is the past tense for come. And now if I had a choice between caming or coming, I think I'd take coming. Come to believe. Well, when I read Bill's story, see, I had a bit of a problem with Bill's story, because Bill's story, he has that come experience in the bedroom, in the hospital, the bright light experience. See, that didn't fit with me. That didn't. If I was waiting for that, I'd probably still be drunk. And so that bothered me somewhat. It said, came to believe. I realized if you came, like you've already come. You've already come, it already happened to you. And when I looked at it that way, I thought, hey, this already happened. What is this? This is 3 months and one day. I've been sober 3 months, longer than I've ever been sober in my life, plus one day. I'm in virgin territory here. How is this possible for a Lysol-drinking scumbag like me to stay clean and sober that long? Something's going on and I don't know what it is. But all of a sudden it occurred to me that maybe this God thing, maybe there was something to this. Because all these people, all these men out at King Haven were able to keep this nut clean and sober that length of time. And as time went on and I looked at step three, that God step, I thought, you know, again, it's a case of we hear things, we hear them over and over and over and over again. But like, when does the nickel drop for you? When does the light go on? I heard, they just read it here today, how it works. God could and would if he were sought, it says. I'd heard that thousands of times. I didn't know what the hell that meant. I'm running around King Haven looking for God in all the wrong places. Where is he? Talking to Indian guys, talking to East Indian guys, talking to Christian guys, talking to all kinds of guys, trying to figure this out. I go back to my hippie beginnings, my Zen Buddhism. I go back to my Catholicism. I go all over the place. I'm so goddamn confused. Where is God? What is God? It says God could and would if he were sought. I had to use my dictionary again. I looked up the word sought. It's a past tense too, for seeking. If you're looking, you're home free. I'd had step three all my life and didn't even know it. I was part of. I'm sure glad I figured that out. Made step four a lot simpler. And when I looked at the wreckage of my life, and I thought, recovery, like what is recovery? I used to wonder that sometimes. What exactly is recovery? Now again, you see, I don't know anything when I first came around here. If you recover something, you've obviously lost it. And you want it back. You want to recover it. So what did I lose? Well, my innocence. I had lost my innocence. I had lost it a long time ago. And I'd lost it with a lot of adults who I trusted, who should have taken care of me, who should have been concerned with that whole child that they had in their care. But they didn't do that. They did things to me that scarred me and twisted me and hurt me and humiliated me. And most of them did it unknowingly. And that's the painful thing. Most of them did it unknowingly. You know, I think of the situation in grade one where I have to bring up my welfare papers to be signed. And the whole class now knows that I'm on welfare. Humiliated me and shamed me in front of all my peers. That wasn't done on purpose. But those scars never left me. And so I come to that place at step four where I have to look at all that stuff. And I have to forgive a whole lot of people. Forgive a whole lot of people. And I have to ask for forgiveness for all the people that I've hurt. And God knows I've hurt a lot of people and I've hurt them real bad. There are some people that know me that don't breathe anymore because they met me. And I had to look at all of that stuff. And I had to get to this place of innocence, this place where I'm okay again. I never, ever, ever thought that I was okay. That's all I ever wanted. You know, I used to run around Vancouver. I'd hit like 13, 14 different places in a night, opening doors and looking. I'd look in, I'd check it out. And if somebody said, Lloyd, what are you looking for? I wouldn't have known what to say. I don't know, but it's not here. All those years, I finally figured out what it is. I was looking for me. That's what I wanted. I wanted to have me back. I wanted to fill that up. I was half empty. And when I did step four and five, I got me back. I'm here 100% today, God damn it. 100%. You know, I got to tell you, I'm a half-breed. I turned into a half-breed when I was 39 years old. I was a Chinaman before that. People would ask me, "You look kind of funny, Lloyd. What are you?" I'd say, "I'm part Chinese. My mother was Chinese." And if you're drinking with me, you just take that answer and move on to some other topic. I heard these snide remarks. You see, when you say Indian, you always got to say drunken Indian. And when I heard that drunken Indian, it just ripped me apart inside, because that was my big secret. Can you imagine looking the way I look? I thought that. Denial is wonderful. You know, I have you know. You see, when you say Indian, you always got to say drunken Indian. And when I heard that drunken Indian, it just ripped me apart inside, because that was my big secret. Can you imagine looking the way I look? I thought that. Denial is wonderful. You know, I have you know, since I turned into a half-breed Indian, I haven't had one goddamn drink. Not one. And my people, I believe, we didn't drink before, see. If you're a real Indian, you won't drink. Indians don't drink. And it's so nice to know that. Today, when I said I want to clean up that word, you know, half-breed. Why do I have to say half-breed Indian? I could say half-breed white man. Well, I could. It's just as valid, right? Yeah, well, you guys made the rules, that's why. I'm changing them, okay? From now on, I'm a half-breed white man. You met your first right here. You know, I say I... Oh, I got to tell you this story in closing. I've been trying to stay away from this story, but what the hell? Guy told me one time, you know, there'll come a time in your sobriety when you'll almost be able to do a fifth step from a podium. I said, "You got to be crazy. Fifth step from the podium?" Well, I'm going to tell you this story just to prove my point. I was in Supreme Court one time, I think it was the time I stabbed that guy, and it was a pretty serious case. I'd run it through court for a couple of years, and my lawyer had said, "I never want to see you come into court drunk or stoned or anything. You better be here always sober, always looking good, because this is serious business." I said, "I have never, when I've been on the street, been to court drunk." And that was true. I had the greatest respect for people that can control my life like that. I suck hole, I do anything. I'm not stupid. I get haircuts and stuff, for God's sake. So I go into court, and I made this promise I wouldn't get stoned. But now it's coming down to the nitty-gritty, and it looks like I'm going to go away for a while. Not 7 years, I hope, but for a while. Because, see, I was guilty. So what I do is I go see a couple of my croakers, Dutch doctors, and I get some of that Valium and some of that Halcyon, and I go sort of make a run down to Skid Row and see a few of the boys, and I pick up a few more pills. So I got a fair whack of pills. Now I'm thinking, what I need to do is I need to take these pills inside with me when they lock me up. So what I do is, I'd had an experience before with a balloon. I swallowed the balloon, but I had to wait like 3 days to retrieve it. And I didn't want to wait that long. So I thought, this is a better way. And this lady I was living with, I wasn't going to go buy, like, you can't buy one balloon. Do you guys know that, don't you? You got to buy 100. They come in packages of 100. It's insane. Anyway, I don't want to buy 100 goddamn balloons.
So I'm with this lady. I'm thinking, well, she'll have something I can wrap this stuff up with. So that night, I'm going into her kitchen cupboards, and I'm looking for, I don't know what I'm looking, plastic bag or something. And I see the Saran wrap. Now, I'm not too fast sometimes. So I take off a couple chunks of Saran wrap, and I divide these pills into two pots, and I tie them all up and everything, and I put them in the fridge. Next morning, I get up to go to court. I take out my two things of pills, and I go into the washroom, and I pack them in my suitcase. Now, some of you won't know what that term means, but I ain't gonna tell you. Find out yourself. So I suitcase these two things of pills, and I go off to court. And I'm sitting in court, and court's going on, and I'm starting to get a little tired. Like, I can hardly keep my eyes open. And I'm getting a little giddy and shit. I want a party and stuff. And the people that are there with me are wondering, what the hell's happening to me? And my lawyer is gunning me off something fierce. And then I told them what I had done, and they said, Lloyd, Saran wrap melts. You could say I was getting stoned out backwards. What we have to do sometimes, you know, to live that life. I don't have to do any of those things anymore. I got suitcases now and bags and stuff. They got nothing to do with my body. I mean, they're leather and everything. I'm legitimate now. You know, and it's all because I came here. You people allowed me to come back here. You know, it's almost trite when we say that you loved me back to life, but you did. You did. And I just hope I have the ability sometimes when I see people come into meetings that have relapsed 100 times, and I look at them and I think, my God, you're back again. I hope when that happens to me, I say to myself, Lloyd, that's you. That's you back again. And I hope when you walk up to people like that, and it's now, it's about now. I mean, I always, every time I come into these rooms, honest to God, when I come into these rooms and I look at you people, I wanted so desperately deep inside me to have what you had. And what you did is you took the time and the patience. You took me to meetings I didn't want to go to. You gave me cigarettes you didn't want to give me. You bought me coffee. You stuck with me. You listened to my insanity. And that was 12 and a half years ago, and I thank you for that. Thanks for my support.